From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez of Al Jazeera America, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The candidates may have taken us on a wild ride, but it's really been average Americans who've made this election interesting, because they haven't done what they were expected, what they were predicted to do. They've been all over the map on who should be the next president. Many of them have this nagging sense that our political system needs a big overhaul. Two Washington Post reporters spent over a month talking to voters in eight states to look at things through their eyes. This hour on Point, looking at 2016 through the eyes of Americans. You can join us on air, online. What do you see going on? Do your relatives and coworkers, your neighbors, see the same problems and solutions as you do? Do you understand why people you know and like are voting for a candidate you don't like? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Before we settle in to listen to voters, let's recap last night's primaries in Utah, Idaho, and Arizona, and the last day's big endorsement. Jen Epstein is a political correspondent with Bloomberg News. We caught up with her in Menlo Park, California, where she's been covering the Clinton campaign. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Ray.
Ted Cruz got a big endorsement overnight. Tell us about it.
Yeah, he got endorsed by Jeb Bush. Maybe not what we would have expected even a few weeks ago, but Governor Bush basically said this is the only conservative alternative to Donald Trump, the only person who could potentially beat Donald Trump in the primary, and so he went with Senator Cruz. And so maybe it would have been surprising in February, but now we're in late March, and this is a point where Governor Bush and lots of other Republicans, we're seeing this, plenty of people who don't really like Senator Cruz are just going with him because he's the best option left and the only way to stop Donald Trump, and that's really what this is about at this point in time. But it may be too little too late when we get down to the delegate count. Last night, Trump, continued to have a dominant performance. Cruz did win in Utah, and those were both winner-take-all for the delegate counts, but it's still not enough for Cruz to really cut into Trump's delegate lead, and it would really take a very striking shift in the contest ahead for Cruz to be able to really make it mathematically impossible for Trump to clinch the nomination before we get to the convention this summer in Cleveland.
The two so-called front runners took the big prize last night, Arizona. Is Arizona a place that could be in play if Donald Trump becomes the nominee?
Yeah, I think that the Clinton campaign certainly sees it that way. They believe that because of the large Latino population there, and really that while there is this big mostly white population that would vote for somebody like Trump because they are concerned and upset about what's happening at their borders, and Trump could kind of taps into that very well, that there's also just this huge turnout of Latinos who are scared about Trump and will turn out and be motivated to go to the polls because they don't want him to become the next president. And I think that Arizona is one of those states where that would be the case, and where I think that you would see the Clinton campaign, and we're just assuming now that she's going to be the nominee, because while Bernie Sanders gained about five delegates on her last night, she's still ahead by more than 300 delegates, and it's a pretty, her campaign is calling it almost insurmountable, and it really is a very mathematically difficult thing for Sanders to get ahead. So, Arizona could be in play. There are a couple of other states that have, a heavily Latino population that could be in play that haven't been in the past for Democrats, or that could be a sure thing for Democrats, like maybe Colorado, which has become a battleground in the last couple of cycles. So, that's kind of jumping ahead, but at this point in time, it's a way for Clinton to continue to have an edge over Sanders, is just winning these more diverse states.
What are the next states that are coming up on the calendar with primaries and caucuses, and what are the next big prizes in terms of delegate hauls?
Well, this weekend on the Democratic side, there's Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington State. Washington State is obviously the biggest of those states, delegate-wise, and the Sanders campaign is expecting to win on the Democratic side on all three of those. If those are places where there's a lot of, you know, left-leaning activists, and because they're caucuses and involves a lot more of a time commitment than just voting, you know, just a standard primary vote. And, you know, but those are places where it may or may not be a blowout for Sanders, and even if it is, that may only gain him a couple dozen delegates. You know, and again, she still has a 300-plus delegate lead. On the Republican side, there's also Washington State this weekend, and you know, it's probably a place where Trump will do okay. You know, then beyond that, there's Wisconsin in about 2 weeks, which is the biggest one coming up for the next few weeks. Again, a place where I think Republicans are looking to try to stop Trump, and there will be a lot of energy put into that in the next few weeks, because it is really the biggest contest ahead. And then beyond that, we get to New York almost a month from now on, I believe, April 19th. And that, on the Democratic side, is something that Bernie Sanders is setting up as this moment where he could potentially cut into the Clinton delegate lead in a bigger way. It's one of the biggest contests so far. You know, 100, 200 delegates there. But that's a place where I think the Clinton campaign is very, very confident, because they feel like even though Sanders, it does have this big white working class population upstate, that Clinton was senator from New York for 8 years, and she spent a lot of time on constituent services to upstate New York, talking about issues like manufacturing and the jobs that are disappearing in that area. And they think that you know, people still remember that, and that they'll take that into account when they vote. And then if you look at New York City and the suburbs, you know, it's a very diverse area that looks like a lot of the states that she's won, places like Florida, and that ultimately she'll do well there, and it'll be the moment when maybe Sanders will have to say, okay, this is really difficult mathematically, but he again is not going to give up. I mean, we're looking 2 months ahead to California. He was campaigning there yesterday and today, and now Secretary Clinton is in California as well, and I'm here with her. And you know, that for her is one about fundraising, but two, it is about an acknowledgement that even if she really does have this mathematical lead, she may not have sewn up enough delegates, at least the pledged delegates, without counting the super delegates, for quite some time, and that this thing, at least at the level of sort of going through the motions week by week, will continue to go on.
Jen Epstein is a political correspondent with Bloomberg News. She joined us from Menlo Park, California. Jen, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
Joining me now from Washington are Robert Samuels, political reporter for The Washington Post, and David Marinus, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and associate editor at The Post. He and Robert Samuels spent about 35 days on the road from late January through early March, visiting 8 states. They've just published a 4-part series called Looking for America. You can find a link to the series on our website, onpointradio.org. Robert, David, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having us, Ray.
Always great to be with you, Ray.
So, Robert, tell us about getting out there to America. You're a New Yorker, right, like me? And what did you see on the road, and what did you learn?
Great. Well, as a person who grew up in the Bronx, there's always something wonderful about seeing the rest of America. And when we went there, we wanted to focus on the question of what it meant to be an American in a time when everything's to be changing and so many people seem to be angry. So we did something that we used to do in this country all the time with our neighbors. We went and we asked people, well, how are you doing? How's the country treating you? How do you feel the country's going? And from there, we sort of built up a melange of different voices and people from all walks of life talking about how this election sort of became a filtering mechanism for how they see the country and how they believe the idea of the American dream is progressing.
David, you won one of the highest honors in our business for your reporting on a political campaign, the 1992 race. Now here we are 24 years later. Was it a different country you were visiting?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, Ray, because I would say that in many respects, what's happening this year is a culmination of a quarter century of sort of the collapse of American institutions, the divide between the two parties, the emergence of basically entertainment and reality television into the political process. And much of that started with that 92 campaign of Bill Clinton and in the Clinton years. So that, you know, I think that what we're seeing this year is really more of a culmination than a vast difference. It's been a gradual process over these 25 years.
Do people realize that? When you're out there talking to them and they look back at the arc of their lives, did they see the seeds of the things they're feeling, the things they're seeing today, back then in that era?
Well, it depends. I mean, some people weren't even born then. You know, the amazing thing is that the first-time voters this year were in elementary school when Barack Obama was elected president. But certainly I encountered several older voters who had sort of seen this eventual erosion of trust in government, of belief in the system, of a sort of a belief in the ascent of humankind, if you might put it, and some concerns about where this country is going, both some, you know, with a vast ideological divide as well.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We are listening. Listening to American voters, trying to get a feel where we are this election season, trying to make sense of the powerful winds blowing through the country now. Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Robert Samuels, political reporter, and David Marinus, associate editor at The Washington Post. They spent over a month on the road talking to all sorts of voters and are now out with a four-part series called Looking for America. You can find a link to the series at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's listen to Molly Parkinson. She's a Miami resident who spoke to the Washington Post about how America has changed racially and ethnically over the years.
America now, it looks so different from the way it used to look when I was a kid, or, you know, maybe even from when my father was growing up here. But it doesn't mean that it's less American because it's changed. It's just evolving.
Robert Samuels, was there an identifiable sense that among the people you were talking to, that the country is sort of shifting under their feet? We get so used to hearing it extolled, celebrated as a great American strength, this complicated tapestry. Are there people, frankly, that it just makes uncomfortable?
Absolutely. I think you feel that sense that something is shifting amongst all racial lines and genders and socioeconomic lines. I think what people are really worried about is their ability to feel like what they thought the American dream would be, you know, the idea that you can do anything you want, you can, if you work hard, you can be upwardly mobile, might be grasping away from them. And that's because it's become a lot more complicated to achieve that dream, right? You know, it's getting harder to get a job, it's getting harder to pay for college. And you see the impact of that really affecting how people feel about the country and their ability to be successful in the country.
David?
You know, I think that all of that is true, and I also think there are some other factors at play. I think that there are a lot of people in this country who have a certain narrow vision of what America really is, and they're afraid of what sociologists call the other. And you see that both in the immigration issue and in terms of frankly, in terms of dealing with the president of the last 8 years. So there are many valid economic reasons and other aspects to the disquiet in the country, and there's also an undercurrent of race and immigration fear involved.
Let's go first to Austin, Texas. Brad is calling. Brad, welcome to On Point.
My comment is, you know, I'm wondering if either your guests could comment on, you know, I realize that presidential politics is a big focus for people in this country. But it seems to me that a big part of the problem is congressional politics. You know, we have an obstructionist Congress that really can't seem to get a whole lot done for our citizens. And yet everyone seems to be taking their anger out on the president. And so I was wondering if your guests could comment on, you know, is it an issue where people like their congressmen, they just don't like Congress? Or are they just really not participating in congressional elections, and so continues to be an issue, and on we go.
Does the upset, the anger, get that specific, David?
Well, I would say that yes, and it's interesting, and that too crosses ideological divides. Among many Democrats, you'll find a sensibility that it's really the obstructionism of the Republican Congress that is responsible for much of the disquiet in America today. On the Republican side, especially among voters for Donald Trump, you'll find an anger at the Republican majority in Congress for not doing what they promised to do. So in both senses, I think underlying much of the anger this year is Congress, although it's not directly attacked in that fashion. It's more focused on the presidential debate. The caller's absolutely right, but Congress is at the root of it in many ways.
I think if I could add something to that as well, I think when people look at a presidential election, they see something that's very important, and they're looking at a person who can serve as a leadership figure who can represent the best of what the country is and what the country needs most importantly. So I think a lot of attention's paid towards the presidential election because they're looking for someone who might be able to solve a lot of the theoretical problems they're seeing. Sort of the discord and the unsettlement mm-hmm. that people feel in this country, a lot of it doesn't have to do with politics. It has to do with the fact that the country is changing. It's becoming a lot less simple. It's become a lot more diverse. And they're looking for someone who can symbolically help them understand that.
Robert, we talk so little about the fact that we expect the president, because in this country we don't have a separate person who's head of state and another one who's the head of the government, one who does sort of grubby politics and one who personifies everyone as a symbol for the state. We have that person in one person, and it must have rocked a lot of people's worlds to have Barack Obama be the literal personification of America to the rest of the world. And without putting too fine a point on it, it was not something that a lot of them had ever seen coming. From a listener on Twitter, Roger Hurt, government is the art of compromise. The GOP refuses. Mike writes on our website, if the media doesn't know America, how can we expect those who represent Americans to know America? It's not like either of them talk to us. You know, there is a lot of hostility toward our business, David. The
to
idea,
put it mildly.
The idea that you have to get out there to get to people is an important one, but one that almost seems sort of obvious.
Well, you know, it's hard to even define what the media is these days. I mean, it's as inchoate as anything else in the modern American life. But you're right. I mean, I think that the technology, the technological advances in the media, like everything else, are a boon and a bust in many ways, and they allow a lot of disinformation to be spread. They allow people to just sort of turn to what makes them feel comfortable, as it sort of in many ways provides both more information than we've ever had and more disinformation. And that complicates the political process in many ways. You know, a lot of these newspapers and other organizations try to focus on whether the candidates are telling the truth or not with PolitiFact and Pinocchio's and all kinds of different manners of looking at their statements. And yet the actual fact seems to be up in the air these days. And you know, if you look at Donald Trump voters, for instance, I think essentially what we found is he could say almost anything and it wouldn't affect how they feel about him. And that's because there's something deeper involved in why they're turning to him. And so all of that complicates the issue with the media.
David is up next. He's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hiya, David.
Hi, Ray. Happy to have you on hosting for Tom. I'm a big fan of yours as well.
Thanks.
Although I miss Tom, of course. But I just have two quick points. First was about your initial guest. She was saying how Bernie was going to do better in the caucuses, and he will. He's going to win Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington by large margins. But she said it's because people were more willing to wait in line. And if Arizona is any estimate, people were waiting in Arizona 6 hours to vote, an absolute travesty. in an election where the president of the United States is often called the leader of the free world. So that was a disgrace, Arizona primary. We need to work on our primary reforms. There's been too many problems with the polls throughout the election. But you were asking, your question is, why are voters not acting the way they're supposed to? And for one, I think the primary influence, at least on the Democratic side of this election, has been the millennial generation. I'm 32, so I'm just barely in there. But I'll say I was born in 83. I've never lived under a true democracy in America. Ever since McCutcheon's in 78 going up to Citizens United recently, it just opened more and more dark money into the process. There are literally very few politicians, I feel, are not completely bought and sold by lobbyists from Big Pharma, Wall Street, the military-industrial complex. And I think Bernie Sanders is only viable because millennials have grown up with increasing student debt, bankruptcy laws that are written for the corporations and not for students, lowering power, purchasing power from minimum wage, and they are just sick of it. They don't want to get sick and become bankrupt, so they're for Medicare for all. They don't want to be in debt for 30 years, so they're for free college education as a right for everyone. So I think as far as it goes going forward, Hillary Clinton needs Bernie's millennial voters much more than Bernie needs to consolidate and stop attacking her and get out of the race. So I think as far as it goes going forward, Bernie Sanders is not bought and sold for. He gets his donations, $27 a pop. I just gave him $5 today. And so as long as he's going, they're going to have to account in both parties, because the only reason I think Trump's getting the support he's getting is because he said he's self-bought. Now, of course, he talks about this corruption, but at the same time, he's a problem because he's bragging about how he bought politicians, and he's saying he's self-financing, but he's loaned the money to his campaign. He didn't give it. So as far as it goes, you could have Sanders crush Trump in a general election, or you could watch Trump actually use this as a wedge against Clinton in the general election and bring on neo-fascism. So thank you very much for your time. And I appreciate the opportunity to call in.
David, thanks for your call. Robert, this is not sort of undefined free-floating anger. David's obviously thought a lot about what's making him mad. Is there a generation gap in the kinds of things you heard from people when you talk to them? David's 32. He's grown up in an era where money has taken a larger and larger role in our politics, and that's created, you could hear it, brimming with distrust.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing in David's passion is not something that's unusual across the country. For many young people who he spoke with, they almost look with a mystical sense at a time when they thought politics was working and politics was pure, the time they hear their parents talk about in the country. And it's something they've never really seen. That's a big problem for someone like Hillary Clinton, who they feel is the vanguard of that old type of politics, that sort of relationship with banks and people and lobbyists and people who can pay her to vote on things that they want her to vote for. That increases and sows seeds of distrust amongst people who might vote for her otherwise. And I think one of the things that is important to note is, while it's very strong amongst the millennial generation, it's not just the millennials. One of the people that we followed in the series was a 70-year-old woman who was running her 11th caucus in Dubuque, Iowa. She was a Trump supporter, and she too was tired of the way politics in Washington was being played, that she thought the banks had too much influence and increasing influence, and that politicians were increasingly moving away from people like her, people on the ground, and more towards people that she could not see, toward the dark money that helps to perpetuate some of the stereotypes we see about how politics is being run in Washington.
Pamela, so, yeah. I'm going to go next to the phones from Belvedere, Vermont. Pamela's with us now. Pamela, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you. I'm hearing what you're saying about the 70-year-old woman, and I'd like to agree with that, because a lot of older people, and I deal with a lot of people, I work for a nonprofit, I deal with a lot of people, especially people that are in need, and a lot of the older people are really irritated and confused by this contest because they don't like any of the candidates. Even the ones that are Republicans don't like any of the candidates, even though everybody's throwing their weight behind Trump. And they feel underrepresented. And it's understandable, because they just don't know who they can trust, and they don't trust any of them.
Well, Pamela, let me ask you something. You talk about not liking any of the candidates, and that leaves you with two choices. You either settle and vote for the least worst, but I'm getting a lot of mail from people who say, I can't stand that. I can't stand the idea that I have to vote for out of a menu of bad choices for the one who repels me the least.
I have to say, in my entire, and I'm in my late 40s, and in my entire voting record, I've always written in Ralph Nader. Because I refuse to settle for anyone. I want somebody that I can believe in. I'm not going to not vote, but I am going to vote for somebody that I personally think would do a better job anyway.
David, did you hear dissatisfaction with the choices when you were on the road?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, another part of that that is important to remember when you talk about looking for America is that a lot of people just don't vote. You know, it's still, you know, even in presidential elections, 40% of the people are not voting at all. And some of that has to do with just already giving up on the whole system. But I did find a lot of people who were, you know, here you had, what, 17 or 18 Republican candidates, and yet you can find people who say they're not satisfied with any of the choices. I found that to be even more true, perhaps, on the Democratic side, although I didn't find anybody who said they would not vote on the Democratic side because of the choices. But you know, in Dubuque, Iowa, I talked to some very, very intelligent young Hillary Clinton supporters who were leading the canvassing there. And they basically said that they were supporting Mrs. Clinton largely as a placeholder because they liked Barack Obama so much and they thought that she would follow through on his legacy more than Bernie Sanders was. You also found an enormous amount of people on the Democratic side, Clinton supporters again, who were doing it for basically pragmatic reasons and not the same sort of adulation and fervor that they brought to the Obama campaign.
Your 5 weeks on the road spanned from January through early March, which was, coincidentally, a time at which, during which, Donald Trump moved from being kind of a novelty act in American politics to a plausible nominee by the time you came back to Washington to write up the things in your reporter's notebook. Could you feel that happening as you were out there?
Oh, absolutely. I think leaving, there was a sense that Donald Trump was a novelty act. But once we got to Iowa, it became clear that this was very, very real and that people were taking him seriously. And as time went on, you saw people coming to his rallies and listening to his speeches who said at first they weren't sure, but now they're really taking a look. They're taking a hard look at it. And a hard look at him. And one of the things that really helped him was he remained his true self throughout that period of time. He remained sort of the braggadocious, plain-spoken the New Yorker that he always was, where you saw some of the other candidates kind of oscillating, going after him in very guttural ways, in a lot more different types of senses. So yeah, that was very different.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the American voter in an unusual presidential election season. You can join the conversation, whether you're for Hillary, Bernie, Donald, Ted, John, or none of the above. How important this time is it that we get the right person for the job? Are you a damn the torpedoes voter or a whoa, wait a minute voter? Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, at On Point Radio. David Marinus and Robert Samuels of The Washington Post are my guests today. They've been sharing their impressions of the 35 or so days they spent on the road in 8 states talking to Americans about this election. They have a new four-part series running in the paper now called Looking for America. You can find it by going to our website, onpointradio.org. Along with Anger and Division, there were beautiful reflections of the diversity and sort of the essential nature of America. David Luxinger used to work as the superintendent of the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island. He talked to the Post about how his own story affected his view of immigration.
I realized an American dream in my career. Working for the National Park Service, I started as a WG1 seasonal laborer, which is the lowest graded employee you can be in. And I worked my way up to become the superintendent of the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island. Now, we still need to have those folks coming in and embracing our way of life and embracing this country.
And maybe in 2016, we don't mean the same thing we used to in 1956 or 1986 when we used the word community. But Nakia Ali finds it. She's a South Carolina State University student who told the Washington Post she believes social media can help unite the country.
I don't feel like the country is more divided. I feel like social media is actually bringing more people together, allowing people to see different views, different opinions. And I think if we continue on this road of positivity, like one day we will be united.
Robert Samuels and David Marinus are with us, and Tom is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Tom, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Ray. I was wanting to comment on how lost we seem to be from the era of JFK and his appeal to ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. We seem to be so far away from that, we've lost our sense of what the common good is, and so we have self-indulgently and materialistically asked our politicians to just give us what we want, and the heck with what everybody else wants. And our politicians, you know, we get the politicians we deserve. They're the ones who are pandering to us, and we don't like that, but we don't really know how to ask for different people. So we're disgusted, we're angry, and we don't know how to express our anger and discontent.
Tom, can I half agree with you? I think you're right about the old Kennedy formation. 50%. We don't, may not be asking what we can do for our country. I don't know if a lot of people think about what the country can do for them anymore. A lot of people have sort of given up on the idea that government does much well, and does much for them.
But what they really do want, it seems, when you ask them, is something that their country can do for them. They want tax breaks. They want not to pay taxes if it comes down to it. They want something for nothing. They want free education. I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter who just cannot understand how Bernie Sanders can offer everybody free education, at least on a community college level. And people don't understand that, you know, they're not going to get this for free. Someone's going to have to pay for it.
David Marinus?
You know, there are a lot of elements to that, and they cross the ideological divides. There's a certain segment of the population who feels that the government is helping everybody but them, and that the money is going in the wrong places, and that can be people who think that too much is being spent on foreign policy, too much is being spent on the military, or too much is being spent on the social program. So that cuts across a lot of levels, but you do see that. And I think that I agree with you, Ray, that it's sort of, I see the first half of that very powerfully all throughout the country. But then when you come to what the government is doing for people, I think it divides more along sort of narrow, self-interested lines.
John is calling now from Richmond, Vermont. John, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
Okay.
I was thinking this at a more higher, you know, system kind of level, and our government is based on building consensus. It's hard. It's a harder way to run a government because it requires conversation and compromise. Now, sometimes that leads to bad decisions, like including, you know, slavery in the Constitution, but it forces sides to talk to each other. You talk about the JFK era. the reason why the civil rights legislation got through because LBJ was able to move the Congress and the country in a direction because he had a practical side to his ideological bent. We're missing that. We don't have the whole picture anymore. Our leaders are either on one side or the other, and they're taking the populace in all directions. We're a country based on values, and without those, you know, an agreement on some basic values, we're going to fall back on the traditional barriers, which would be ethnic makeup, religious background, race, you name it, and those are all dividers. We need leadership that bridges that, and I'm not sure where that's coming from these days.
Robert Samuels?
I think that's a very interesting point. I think the real sticky point in the country nowadays is what are those universal values? One of the most interesting conversations that we had was with a group of evangelicals. And at the end of the day, when they started talking about how they would not compromise on things like abortion or gay marriage, I said, well, what do you say to people who say you're the problem because you're saying you're unwilling to compromise? And their response was, well, we can't compromise our righteousness. And so I think one of the big issues in the country is that we all haven't agreed on the things that are absolutely proper to be righteous about. For someone like Nakia Ali, what she's asking of her country is for them to not have police who would shoot her brothers without any proper pretext, if there ever could be one, and to fairly adjudicate cops who would do such a thing. And that's her righteous value. And so I think that's the question that we all need to start thinking about in terms of, you know, what are the values that make us American, and how do those things play along all sorts of lines?
Let's go next to Quincy, Illinois. Ralph is with us now. Ralph, welcome to the program.
How are you guys?
Terrific.
Great.
This is a little intimidating. I've never done this before, but we're getting ready to get the fields ready to plant corn, and I had you guys on the radio, so I thought I'd call in.
Terrific.
I'm 25, and this is my second presidential election that I have been able to vote in, and this is probably the most difficult one for me. Because there's not really a candidate out there that, to me, is moral as far as, you know, they want for the what's good for the common, you know, overall, rather than, you know, what the church wants or what the wealthy want or, you know, redistributing everything. And so it's been kind of hard. You know, I watch both sides of the debates. I try to do my research. I spend a lot of time in a tractor, so there's tons of free time because it steers itself to, you know, brush up on your knowledge. And it's just, it's kind of scaring me the way things are, you know, headed with the Trump support, which shows how frustrated America is. And, you know, family dinner has been awkward because I voted for Bernie in the primary, and now my family's not speaking to me because they've always voted Republican. So it's just kind of hard because after college, I took off and went overseas for a while, and you go to a few countries that have more than one party, and you can kind of rationalize, you know, what party you would vote with over there. And then you come back here to America, and, you know, last fall we had, what, 12, 13 candidates, and out of those, all but one said God told them to run. And that just kind of, I feel like Abraham Lincoln was rolling over in his grave at what his party's become. Because it seems to me that it's completely flip-flopped from the Democratic Party in the 60s as far as their overall values and the way they treat people that are different. And so sitting here is, would I fall into the millennial group?
Yeah, you are. And also, because you're 25, it may be that idea that God told them to run is jangling with you a little bit because millennials as a group are not going for those kinds of appeals in their politics. David, you want to talk to Ralph?
Well, Ralph, I'm curious why you voted for Bernie.
Well, because he's the only one that actually seems to care about the environment, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
With fracking back on the rise here, and I mean, I'm in Illinois. We're the most political nightmare state in the entire country. We have one city up in the Northwest that controls everything south of it. Our legislators deadlocked. You know, we need a complete legislative overhaul, for lack of a better word. I mean, what we have is not working, and it just blows my mind that people can't see it, that, you know, Chicago can't run Illinois anymore. But here we are.
Well, that's another level of... I'm sorry, go on.
Yeah. That's another conversation over a cold beer.
Okay. But you said you couldn't find anybody with the moral values that you really connected
I identified the most with Kasich. Yeah. But Kasich's stance on Planned Parenthood was what drove me away from him, because to me, I don't understand why more Republicans aren't for Planned Parenthood, because effectively it keeps more people off welfare.
Well, you know, the Planned Parenthood used to be a very strong, moderate Republican position, birth control as well. So you're right. The Republican Party has probably changed more over the last 30 years than anything in America.
And Quincy, for those who have never been to Illinois, it's a pretty conservative part of the state, and it looks at Chicago as being very far away and very much removed from its concerns. And when a farmer knocks a candidate for not being right on climate change and the environment, that's always a moment where you sort of catch yourself and remember that politics is not stereotypical.
Ray, if I could
add
to that, that's really the reason that we did this project. It was more than anything else that polls and election results tend to smooth over and homogenize the idiosyncrasy of why people actually vote the way we do and the way they do. And what Robert and I really wanted to do was give voice to those very personal idiosyncratic reasons that we all have for our existence.
Robert, is this going to affect your reporting going forward? Do you think you have a better handle on the United States in 2016 now?
Well, it's the sort of reporting that I do typically. I think what's instructive for me are stories like Ralph's, you know, the constant reminder that we live in a messy time and that people are surprised by how willing people are want to talk about how messy and how confused and how unhappy they are. And I think that's a conversation that's been largely missing from a lot of the media coverage about this. At some point, our political coverage became overwhelmed by the ideas of polls and predictions. And while those things have values, they don't tell the full story, the true stories of people. And I think when we include stories like Ralph and a lot of the people we spoke with over the course of that month, it really helps to influence and shed light on not only what we do as journalists, but hopefully that it allows the country to see itself in a clearer and actually a little bit more complicated way than it would without that sort of reporting.
We have time for one more call this hour. We'll go to Sister Bay, Wisconsin, where Dick is standing by. Dick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thank you. I listened to your callers, and it's so interesting to me. You talked about the one caller who said that she's voting for Donald Trump because of the whole problem with the banks. And it's ironic because so much of the tail is wagging the dog. You know, this is a global society. We don't sit around at 5:30 and watch Walter Cronkite anymore and get 30 minutes of news. We now get it 24/7. And it appears to me that this reminds me a little bit of the utopian novel Lord of the Flies, where, you know, the island is now being taken over by tyranny, and Piggy's head is in jeopardy. And eventually, the island is rescued, and the righteous prevail. But I'm not sure that I don't think anything will ever be the same with the global economy and the internet and the amount of information that's out there. I think the NAFTA and trade agreements have been great success to our neighbors to the south and to the countries that we support. And yet we now turn our backs on that, and it's just interesting.
Dick calling from Sister Bay, Wisconsin. Human 2013 writes on Facebook, America worked well as a melting pot because it was possible for immigrants, including the poor and less educated, to come and enjoy a prosperous life. In today's America, big business is crushing small proprietors and banks aren't helpful in distributing capital. The only immigrants welcome today are hard laborers and H-1B holders. That's it for this hour. David Marinus is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and associate editor at The Washington Post. David, great to talk to you.
You too, Ray. Thank you very much.
And Robert Samuels is a political reporter at The Washington Post. Robert, it was a pleasure having you.
It was wonderful. Thank you, Ray.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, after Brussels, Europe is taking another look at the human wave from the Mideast and Africa. We'll look at mounting tension over the EU's migrant crisis. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.